Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the second hour, at least for the next 25 minutes, it's your questions, your comments. Our call-in numbers 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In just a minute, we're going to be hearing from one Reverend Veazey. He was not happy with the president's signature on the partial birth abortion ban today. And he's speaking as, at least ostensibly, as a Christian minister, saying why this is a bad idea and why he and other Christian organizations, denominations, support an unrestricted access, including partial birth abortion and Roe v. Wade. That's in a minute. But first, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is one of the nearest and dearest guests here on Issues Etc. I merely speak the name and people begin to call wondering, when is he going to be? Is he coming on? Is he going to be on the show again? It's true. Our listeners love Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. And there's good reason. He is one of the leading Christian apologists, thinkers, prolific writer, and attorney for human rights organizations. He is perhaps of the highest caliber of guests. And that's saying something when you talk about the stable of guests that we have here on Issues Etc. He's going to be coming into town here in mid-November. He's going to, if we can arrange this, he's going to be speaking with us here on Issues Etc. again, and hopefully we'll have him here in town, in studio as well. Now, what we'd like to do, and he is in no need of this, but we'd like to do this. When he comes in, he's going to be staying at a hotel near the airport because his time with us will be very limited, as it always is. We would like to be able to provide him at least a gift of thanks to him as he visits us, because he doesn't have to come and see us when he comes to the United States once a year, but he does, such as his loyalty to Issues Etc. and to my producer, Jeff Schwartz. Like a son to him, he once said. Well, we'd like to be able to provide him with a little bit of a gift, and that is to pay for his hotel room when he is here in St. Louis. It's $140, and what I'm asking for is a donation from one of our listeners. Now, if you'd like to be the benefactor of Dr. John Warwick Montgomery and help us thank him for coming in and talking to us in mid-November, you can call my producer, Jeff Schwartz, at 314-505-7832. 505-7832. That's the direct line to the office of my producer. $140 donation to Issues Etc. to help thank Dr. John Warwick Montgomery when he visits us in mid-November. 314-505-7832. It's open lines. Let's talk first with Claire. She's calling from her car. Claire, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. I'm calling both as a female in regard to this abortion bill, as well as a nurse. First of all, and mother. First of all, I 25 years ago tomorrow, I gave birth to a 6 month fetus child, whatever, and she lived for 5 minutes. And we have had to go through the grief of losing this child all these years because we really were ready to have this daughter. But as a nurse, I know that any abortion between the months of the 4th and the 6th month, which is the second trimester of a pregnancy, is a very crucial time not to have any kind of abortion or anything else. It's been told to us in all of our education that that's not a good time because there's extensive bleeding at that time as opposed to the first trimester or the last trimester. And I can't understand the minds of the people who are against the bill or the law as opposed to supporting what they have put into law.
I can't understand it either, Claire, and especially I cannot come from the mother's perspective nor from the medical perspective, but I thank you for bringing it to our attention as well. You know, that's what I also wonder about. These who are speaking out against this, there are women out there who either out of ignorance or out of desperation or simply out of a misinformed conscience have undergone abortions of all kinds and lived to regret it. The children did not live, but they lived. These women lived to regret it, having killed their own children. I wonder what they are thinking when they see people adamantly standing up in support of partial birth abortion, especially when you understand what it is. Just yesterday we talked with the Justice for All people from Mizzou, and they were talking about a display that they put up on the campus of Mizzou that showed the gruesome results of abortion? We're not talking about masses of tissue when we're talking partial birth abortion. We're talking about fully formed babies who are born with all, with the exception of their head, sometimes held in the birth canal by the abortionist before they're killed. You don't even have to get two sentences into that description before people say, I don't want, they start turning off the radio. I don't want to hear that. There's a reason. Not only that it's gruesome, it's wrong. I'd like your reaction to the partial birth abortion ban as well. The president put his signature on it today. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, as promised, there was one Reverend Carlton Veazey on hand for the president's signature. He reacted to the partial birth abortion ban. He's the president of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. Now, Veazey says that many mainline churches and synagogues believe that women have a religious right to abortion.
We're a coalition of over 40 denominations and religious organizations, such as United Church of Christ, Episcopal Church, Presbyterian Church, USA, the Unitarian Universalist, and many Jewish organizations. Most of them agree that this should be left up to a woman, her doctor, and her God.
All right. Now, we hear this all the time, especially from the religious types. This is a decision that should be left up to a woman, her doctor, and her God. First of all, note the list of groups that he has who say support and abortion and therefore oppose the president's signature on the partial birth abortion ban. He mentioned the UCC, the United Churches of Christ, the Episcopal Church USA. Why have they been in the news lately? The Presbyterian Church USA, the Unitarian Universalists. Folks, in case you don't know, he's not talking about the mainstream of American Christianity. He is talking about the farthest liberal fringe, theologically, socially, morally. He's talking about the extremes, although he would like to portray it as the mainstream. But I want to take up this issue, and we'll hear a little bit more from VC here in just a second. This issue of a decision that should be kept between a woman, her doctor, and her God. You know what? I actually agree with that. I'm adamantly opposed to abortion in every one of its forms, but I agree. I would agree that if this were a decision that were between a woman, her doctor, and her God, in principle, I wouldn't have a problem with that. Because that would assume that the woman would hear not only what her own conscience was saying, which might be in error, and what her own doctor was recommending, which also might be in error, but all of that could be corrected by what God had to say on the issue. And, you know, God speaks so very clearly on this issue, thou shalt not kill. He abhors the taking of innocent life. Abortion is but one form of that, but he abhors this. Abortion is wrong in the eyes of God. Now, if a woman whose conscience could err and a doctor whose advice could err, if God were also in on the decision, I wouldn't have a problem with that because God would say you're both wrong and a woman shouldn't have an abortion if it really were a decision between a woman, her doctor, and her God. But he's not being genuine when he says this. What he's really talking about is keeping the decision between a woman and her doctor. God just gets thrown in to make it sound religious. If they were listening to God, if he had any part in this decision whatsoever, we would not have women having abortions. Here's Pastor Veazey again. He says that abortion is not only a constitutional right, it's also a religious right.
I stand on the constitutionality of a woman's right to have an abortion, but I also believe that a woman must make this decision based on her religious beliefs. In fact, our mission at the beginning was to ensure a woman's right to determine when or whether to have children according to her own conscience and religious beliefs. We think this is a religious freedom issue also.
A religious freedom issue. I have to admit, that's the first time I've heard someone actually come out and say it. Although I've heard people intimate that a woman's right to choose is somehow a religious freedom. But here you go. Pastor Carlton Veazey says it's a religious freedom issue. Now, let's just play that out for a second, if you will indulge me. He is actually saying that to tell a woman that she cannot have an abortion, and let's just use the case that's in front of us, partial birth abortion, to tell a woman that it is illegal for her to request and receive from a doctor a procedure that would kill her child after her child has been born, infanticide. Let's just call it what it is. He is actually saying that to tell someone that infanticide is wrong is to curtail their practice of religious freedom. What religion, pray tell, please, tell me, what religion on the face of the earth has as part of its practice infanticide? And with the, do you know of one? I know there have been religions in the past and perhaps in the dark spaces of where civilization has yet to shine its bright light. I know there have been religions that practice child sacrifice and infanticide. I don't know of any religion here in the United States that is calling on the basis of religious freedoms guaranteed in the Constitution to practice infanticide. And yet, Pastor Vesey seems to have no problem saying, look, infanticide is part of our freedom of religion. I ask again, what religion has as part of its practice infanticide? He can't be talking about Christianity. I don't have the whole thing memorized, but I do consider myself a pretty thorough student of the Bible, of Christian history and theology. And I cannot recall any place in Holy Scripture, any leading theologian, any Orthodox movement within Christianity, any church father, any confession that says that part and parcel of the practice of the Christian religion is infanticide. I would love to hear someone ask him that question. Oh, so in other words, you believe that a woman who is a Christian, in order to freely practice her religion as a Christian, needs to be able to kill her baby. Well, this all takes on a very religious sounding air when you say it's a decision between a woman, her doctor, and her God. What God? What God tells a woman to kill her baby? You know, there are answers to those questions. I wonder if you know what they are. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with this caller in St. Louis. Welcome to Issues, Etc. Hello.
I'm here.
Yes. What's your question or comment?
Well, I think it's wrong to do what they do, have babies, and hurt them like that. It's killing them. If you're Christian or not Christian or whatever you are, it's still wrong. It don't make it right, no matter who you are. All must come in a judgment seat of God. We're all going to come. We're all going to have to bow down to our Maker.
It sounds as though this issue has a certain personal flavor for you. Is that true?
Yes, it's a certain flavor for me. I couldn't have any children. And hear all these here people killing their babies. It just hurts to hear such things. I mean, you don't know what these kids would grow up to be, the ones that they're killing, and what they might be. They might be preachers. They might be doctors. They might be lawyers. You don't know what they're going to be if they would go ahead and have them, especially perfect children. If they don't want children, don't have sex.
That's a pretty good way of putting it. Thank you very much. You know what? She's actually put her finger on what's really going on here. And we've talked with many people on this issue. What's behind? You know, we can construct an elaborate conspiracy of dark forces to say that, you know, this really is a dark conspiracy in our culture to do away with children. And it actually is. There's no doubt about that. But what is the thinking? What's the human thinking? There's no doubt about the fact that there's nothing that the enemy, that Satan would want more in this world than to harm those who are the most helpless of all. He's a murderer and a liar. So there's no doubt he's behind this. But I wonder, what's the human thinking? And I think that our caller there has put her finger on one of the major elements of the human thinking behind those who would say A woman must have a right to terminate a pregnancy, to kill her child, however, whenever she desires. Now, you notice that the Reverend Vesey put it in terms of a woman should have the right to decide when she's going to have children, whenever and however she desires. And I agree with him. I agree with him that a woman should be able to decide when she has kids. But I think the decision actually comes before she's pregnant, doesn't it? My predecessor in this chair, Don Matzett, said that he was pro-choice prior to conception. I think he was right. If you don't want the baby, don't have sex. Preconceptionally pro-choice. That's where the decision is made. And that's what lies behind this. The sexual revolution, it sounds so quaint to even talk about it now, the sexual revolution essentially had an inescapable logic that leads in this direction. Once we decided that human sexuality was, in essence, just one of the big red balls on the playground that we can toss around however we feel we want to. Once we decided that human sexuality was not connected in any real way to procreation, once we decided this, we set ourselves on a track that would lead us inevitably, and I'm just frankly surprised it took as long as it did. It only took, what, maybe 10 years before the ideas of the sexual revolution found their way into the Supreme Court of the United States, and we had someone saying, look, privacy in the Constitution includes, and there is a right to privacy in the Constitution, it's just not what everyone always talks about. It's the Fourth Amendment. You have a right against illegal search and seizure. You have a certain realm of privacy that you live in. Without a warrant, they can't come in and rifle through your stuff or mess with your person. Fine. That's what the Constitution says. But the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973 decided that privacy extends to a woman's right to keep the fact that she's sleeping around a secret. And one of the necessary elements to keeping that sleeping around a secret is, you know, people see you walking around pregnant, they're going to figure it out, right? David Letterman, did you hear this? David Letterman announced on the air that he's got a child, and no one knows whether it's in or out of wedlock. Even the press cannot discover whether or not David Letterman is married to the woman that had his child. He quipped when he announced the birth. Here is proof positive that I've had sex. It's funny. Yeah, it is. He said, it's proof positive I've had sex. And he shows a picture of his newborn child. He's got a point, though. Did you know this? That the Roe v. Wade court reasoned that if a woman had to walk around pregnant, that would violate her right to privacy and keep private the fact that she sleeps around. Because people would figure it out. Ah, she's pregnant. She must have had sex. And so to protect her privacy in this matter, she must be granted the right to have an abortion, to get rid of the baby. In other words, to get rid of the evidence that she was sleeping around. That is precisely the Roe Court's logic. I didn't know this until about 2 years ago, but if you read the decision, this is precisely how they got from privacy to abortion. A woman has a right to hide the fact that she's been sleeping around, and to destroy the evidence of it, namely the baby, she needs to have an unfettered right to abortion. Roe v. Wade was one of the stops along the way of the grand railroad we call the sexual revolution. And our caller there is right to point it out. If you don't want the baby, don't have sex. Unfortunately, the train has left the station. Just an update here in the time that we have left. A coroner in California has confirmed that a California teenager's death did result from complications caused by the use of the abortion drug RU486. It's been confirmed by a coroner. The Food and Drug Administration says it is now going to conduct, quote, an intense inquiry into the September death of Holly Patterson, 18. I thought she was 19. Now she's 18. Next time we hear about it, she'll be 17. In addition, members of Congress are preparing legislation to suspend the FDA's approval of RU486. That's Representative Jim DeMint, who's a Republican of South Carolina. He and some fellow members of the House of Representatives will seek to halt the use of RU486 and to review the FDA's approval of the drug. DeMint plans to introduce the RU486 Suspension and Review Act tomorrow. Now, there's a bright side to this. There's no silver lining to the whole abortion thing. It's just a bad thing from beginning to end. But there are people, even after the first legislative victory, after Roe v. Wade in 30 years, just remember that when you read the headlines tonight and when you watch the news tonight, when you hear all of the pro-abortion advocates out there saying how this is a tragedy for our nation and how Roe v. Wade is being chipped away at, remember, this is only the first time any legislation has gotten the president's signature that curtails Roe v. Wade in any way whatsoever. Remember that when you're watching television tonight. This is only the first victory. They will portray it as though Roe v. Wade's about to be overturned. Just remember, it took 30 years to get just this. Mark's calling from his car. Mark, welcome to Issues Etc. Our time is short.
Pastor Todd, I have a question for you.
Yes.
As I understand the logic of partial birth abortion, if I put my kid's head in a bucket, I can jam a screwdriver in the back of his head because he's not really human. Now, you have said in the past that, you know, we have to utilize reason. And this seems to me to be plainly irrational. And I just wonder, where is the place of reason when we see reason so vitiated by sin that, I mean, we are just utterly and wholly irrational?
Mark, you've raised a great question. And the best answer I can give to that doesn't come from me, but it comes from one Dr. J. Budziszewski. He chronicles in two books, one called The Revenge of Conscience and the other one more recently, and we've talked to him about this several times on Issues Etc. The newest one is called What We Can't Not Know. J. Budziszewski. I won't spell it because it wouldn't help you. He's a professor of government and philosophy down at the University of Texas in Austin. Regular guest with us here on Issues Etc. The reason that reason is abandoned is because it is taken captive to a guilty conscience. And the guilty conscience must appease itself at all times. And if that means abandoning logic, and you've pointed it out there very well, if that means abandoning logic, then so be it. A guilty conscience will drive people to do things that are irrational and to state things that are irrational. We've heard some of it already during this hour from the opponents of the partial birth abortion ban, lay and clergy alike. Let me tell you about a pro-life dinner that's going to be held here this coming Tuesday, November 11th. It's at 6:30 to 9 o'clock at the Radisson Hotel in Clayton. It is a pro-life benefit dinner to benefit the Vitae Caring Foundation. It's being put on by Lutherans for Life. I'm going to be the MC. Jennifer O'Neill will be the key speaker there. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Augsburg Confession.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you noticed that Christian devotional material today is sounding less and less Christian? Much of it is filled with generic references to God and empty and crossless pietism, and little to no mention of our sin and God's answer to our sin in the sinless life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Drawn from the writings of 17th century Lutheran theologian Johann Gerhardt, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Meditations on Divine Mercy, is a genuinely Christian devotional book. Find out more about Meditations on Divine Mercy by visiting our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Or you can order Meditations on Divine Mercy by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. When you write or call, mention Issues Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. International reaction to the consecration of homosexual Anglican Bishop Gene Robinson is sharp and threatens to split the church. In African countries where homosexuality is not accepted, the appointment gives the church a black eye. Steve Jordahl reports.
The criticism is especially harsh in Africa, where Archbishop Benjamin Nzibi said, quote, "The devil has clearly entered our church." The culture in Africa clearly has no tolerance for homosexuality in a region decimated by AIDS. Fred Siemlundele, a Christian from Zambia, says the church's reputation is suffering.
I think they are really bringing confusion in the church, and a lot of people in my country, we don't support gay thing. A lot of people, they're running away from the church saying they have lost the direction.
African believers seem to have a firm grasp on a truth that seems to escape many here in the United States.
The Bible clearly states that marriage is for a woman and man, and it's not possible that a gay can stand and preach the gospel.
The Worldwide Anglican Council says it will set up a commission headed by Irish Archbishop Robert Eames to monitor how the appointment is affecting the church. His spokesman, Reverend Brian Parker.
He'll be trying to establish some sort of a guideline or some sort of help to enable debate and discussion to proceed.
Meanwhile, African churches are threatening to separate from the worldwide communion.
Hopefully we will find a way through all this and agree to disagree, perhaps, but at least stay together in the unity of Christ.
Judging from the reaction of the African church, that seems unlikely. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Only one African Anglican leader has spoken out in support of Bishop Robinson. Other branches of the African Anglican Church are asking the church to distance itself from the Episcopal Church. The commission set up by the Worldwide Communion has been given a year to produce a report. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Research has shown that six qualities build strong families. They include commitment to promoting each other's welfare and happiness, appreciation and affection, positive communication, time together, spiritual well-being, and the ability to cope with stress and crises. Join us next time as we partner with the home in growing healthy families.
Family Shield, Saturday mornings at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for November, Meditations on Divine Mercy by Johann Gerhardt. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Meditations on Divine Mercy, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November.
Now, I left myself with just very little time to tell you about this Vitae Caring Foundation dinner that's going to be on Tuesday, November the 11th at 6:30 at the Radisson Hotel in Clayton. That's at 7750 Carondelet in St. Louis, Missouri. I am going to be the MC. This is hosted by Lutherans for Life. This is the third time we've done this. Jennifer O'Neill, actress, film star, will be the featured speaker. Now, if you would like more information on this dinner, this is the kind of dinner where you got to call ahead, make reservations, and put a table together. Don't let me discourage you. We usually pull out a couple hundred people easy. If you want more information on this, if you want to put a table together or find out how you can, call 1-800-393-5791. That's the number for Vitae Caring Foundation. Used to be the Vitae Society. They put together television commercials in regional areas, pro-life commercials of all kinds. And when you come to the dinner, you'll actually probably get to see, usually, they show you the latest commercials they've been putting together and talk about the strategies that they use. And they also show you some of the commercials that pro-choice organizations have put together and show how they're, at least in the world of marketing, trying to oppose some of the messages there. 1-800-393-5791. I hope to see you there. When you come, you'll also get to meet Jennifer O'Neill and hear her story as well. 1-800-393-5791. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to review two best-selling books. One called The Da Vinci Code. You've heard about this, haven't you? The Da Vinci Code. We'll have Christian apologist James Patrick Holding. And then also, we'll be talking about the 11th in the Left Behind series, Armageddon, with our guest, Brent McGuire. He has written a review for our latest Issues Etc. journal as well. We're also going to be discussing several other issues with Dr. Albert Mohler, including the Da Vinci Code. He has a few things to say about it as well. Tomorrow on Issues Etc. For the remainder of the program today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Martin Noland. He's director of the Concordia Historical Institute based here in St. Louis. He joins us here in Studio A. We're coming to the end of a conversation that kind of wrapped around Reformation. And although this is not the end of the story, this is perhaps, well, for some, only the beginning of the story. We're going to talk about what is being called the Magna Carta of the Reformation, the grand document, the Augsburg Confession. We'll explain what it's all about, why it was written, what it has to say, and why has it been so very influential in the Reformation for the last 500 years. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Marty, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Todd.
Tell us a bit about, this is going to put some people off, Augsburg Confession. That sounds like one of these extra-biblical documents that Lutherans are always so fond of. What are we talking about here?
A confession is, first, it's not like you might use the word confession to mean confession of your sins or a confession of guilt. It's not that at all. It goes back to the Latin, and so those two terms have come from the Latin confessio. What it means in a religious context is a public statement of belief. It means it's not just my private ideas. These are ideas that have usually been brought together by a committee, and then people sign on, and everybody knows this is where I stand on a particular belief or doctrine of the Bible. And it's usually also in the form of a summary of the teaching of the Bible. Now, it's not just ideas that people pull out of the air. It is based on the Bible, at least certainly for Protestants, and it's a summary. It takes the main points of what the Bible's trying to get across, and it puts them into a couple of points, maybe 10 to 20, and makes it very clear where you stand on those issues.
So it is little different from, say, Roman Catholic Church came out with their latest catechism, a compendium of Roman Catholic teaching, the main teachings, back in 1995. They're simply confessing what it is they believe Scripture has to say on all these issues, or a local congregation that puts together kind of a what we believe pamphlet to give out to people. They're summarizing what they believe Scripture teaches.
That's correct. The additional item to that, though, is that people subscribe to a confession. That means you put your name on the dotted line, and it's not unlike when you go to get a marriage license. You agree before the state when you're going to get married that you are going to take this person as your lifelong spouse, and there's things that result from this. There are consequences. And a confession is not just a statement of belief, but when you sign the dotted line on here, you know there could be consequences. And so that's usually what a confession is all involved with. It's actually a rather complex thing, but what it really does is it sets up the ability of people to work together in a church.
I want to come back to that issue of subscription to confessions a little later in our conversation. The Augsburg Confession. Tell us about the historical circumstances leading up to this, what some would argue is kind of the first official document of the Reformation.
It's certainly the first legal document at which the Protestant nations or princes or their people stood behind Luther. But it really goes back to Martin Luther. If you remember looking at the film, you can see him. He posts his 95 theses, then he's called into his trial. And for a while, it's just Martin Luther by himself against the Roman Catholic hierarchy and their courts. And then he was condemned by, after he'd gone through this trial, or at least what he had taught was condemned in June 15th by the bull called Exsurge Domino. And it's said that Luther had to recant. Well, we know Luther did not recant. In fact, he threw that bull into the fire. And then when the Roman court found out about this, they published a document called Decet Romanum, January 3rd, 1521, and it condemned Luther and all of his followers. I mean, this is very significant. It's not just directed against Luther, but everyone. And the way the wording is here, it says, Luther and all of his followers, no matter what their rank or dignity, that they are condemned as heretics, and the canonical punishments of heretics should be applied to them. The canonical punishment for heretics was burning at the stake. So anybody that followed Luther, and this is what the Pope was trying to accomplish at the Diet of Worms, the emperor kind of held a middle position. He condemned Luther as an outlaw, but he was not willing to get rid of the princes yet. He thought he could bring the princes over through political work, and he worked on them for 10 years. And it wasn't really until 1530, when the Augsburg Confession was adopted, that Charles V, the emperor, realized he could not bring those princes over and into his own camp.
So this second document condemning Luther and all his followers, regardless of their station or rank, really, in a sense, unintentionally forced the hands of the princes who were in support of Luther to decide whether or not they're going to support him or not, and to formulate a way of telling the emperor, we're going to support him.
That's right. And of course, the Pope and his court knew what they were doing. They were trying to divide Luther from his political supporters, because in that document, it's laid out what the Pope says, according to God. I mean, of course, the Pope speaks for God. This is what's going to happen to you. And so then what you have in those 9 years from 1521 at the Diet of Worms until 1530 at the Diet of Augsburg is the work of the princes in trying to first delay any, trying to accomplish or the consequences of that edict. And then when they finally realized that the emperor was standing firm in, the Diet of Speyer, the second Diet of Speyer in April 1529, six German princes and a number of the cities refused to obey the emperor, and they formally protested. And thus they were called Protestants. That's also a Latin term. They were the protesting princes that they rejected what the emperor was trying to do politically on the against the Lutheran religion. So at that point, in April 1529, they stood up with Luther and said, we're counted with him, we'll take what comes. And so then the Diet of Augsburg in 1530 is really a trial of those Lutheran princes to see if whether they are heretics under imperial law. And so they know that that's coming in a space of a year, and they get to work with their theologians and say, is the Lutheran faith really the faith of the church back to the early Christian time of Nicaea and Constantine, and even back to the apostles? And so what the Augsburg Confession tries to do is not only show the biblical basis, but to show that the Lutheran faith is based on the faith of Nicaea and the early church, and they did that successfully.
Now, they didn't deal, one is often surprised, people who have not read the Augsburg Confession, both Lutherans and non-Lutherans, are often surprised that it doesn't deal with every matter taught by Scripture. It deals with selected matters that were in dispute or in question. And is then one to assume, if the Augsburg Confession doesn't deal with it or mention it, that there was basic agreement between the Lutherans and Rome on that issue?
Well, it actually is, you could say there's three portions of the Augsburg Confession. One portion is the area in which there is pretty much substantial agreement between the Roman Catholics and the Lutherans. Here we're talking about the doctrines of the Trinity, the divinity of Christ, and a number of other things. And so there's pretty much unanimity there. And then there's the areas of doctrine or doctrinal teaching in where there's major differences, especially on the doctrine of justification by faith alone. And even the Roman Catholics recognized that was the dividing point. And then the last part of the Augsburg Confession talks about abuses, which the princes have rejected, the Protestant princes rejected in their church, including the way the Mass was done, the monasteries, mandatory celibacy, and a number of other things. So it's a rather complex document, and it does a lot in a short amount of space.
Was it written to be read by the average person, or was it written as a legal document to be read by the imperial court, and namely the emperor himself, if he was interested?
Now, I don't remember the exact, the presentation was on, let's see here, it was June 25th, 1530. That's when the final copy was read by the princes, or by their readers. But it was written both in German and Latin, and both versions are considered the official documents. The prince was, he spoke Spanish and Latin and German, so it didn't really matter. The emperor did. But it was read in German, and the windows were open, and everybody outside, the people of Germany in Augsburg that day, could hear it being read. So it was intended both to speak to the people and say, this is our faith, certainly the Lutheran faith, and it is also intended in the Latin version more for the theologians to debate and argue against.
Before we get to the content itself, finish the story for us. After June 25th, 1530, and the reading, the presentation of the Augsburg Confession, what occurred at the Diet of Augsburg?
The princes came up to the emperor and said that, in fact, this is well depicted in the movie in one scene, that they are willing to have their heads cut off for the sake of the gospel and what this represents. And the emperor then is kind of embarrassed, and it kind of withdraws his belligerence, at least that day. And he realizes that the German princes were not trying to rebel against him politically. At least the Lutherans were not. They wanted to follow the emperor, and they wanted to be imperial subjects, but they also wanted to follow the Lutheran faith of the Bible. And I think this took Charles V aback. I didn't think he expected that. I thought he thought there would simply be people that are trying to rebel against him. And this, again, is, as said before, is the difference between the Calvinists and the Lutherans. The Calvinists, under Zwingli, rejected the emperor's reign. The Lutherans accepted that reign, and that became very clear at Augsburg. And so, because of the Lutheran prince's willingness to work with him politically, he was not forced to fight against them immediately. Now, they kept fighting back and forth on this up until the end of the 30 Years' War. That's 1648. Took over 100 years before this was finally settled politically. But I think the Lutheran princes really gained Charles V's respect, and he did not do everything that the Pope was asking him to do.
Another thing that surprises people when they find out about this first of the Reformation documents, the Augsburg Confession, is that it is not authored by Luther himself, but primarily by one Philip Melanchthon. Why is this, and tell us who Philip Melanchthon was.
Philip Melanchthon goes back, at least with Martin Luther, to about the year 1518. He was called to be a professor of Greek. He was a Northern Renaissance humanist scholar and a brilliant scholar in Greek. And Luther trained him, you might say, as a young professor there at the University of Wittenberg. And he began teaching some of the courses in theology besides Greek, and wrote the first dogmatics called the Luci Communes in 1521. And after that, Luther had a great admiration for Melanchthon, and they worked side by side, really, in many things. Luther could send Melanchthon and not worry about what was being done. And in the case of the Diet of Augsburg, because Luther was an outlaw, and there was no promised protection from the emperor, the prince refused to let Luther go to Augsburg, and he said, you're going to hole up here at the very southern end of my territory, which was the castle of Coburg. And instead they took Melanchthon and others that were not directly accused or accused of being a heretic like Luther was. As they went through the drafts, and there was earlier confessions that were kind of in a draft form, in the previous year and a half, Luther had a lot of input. So you can't say that Melanchthon is the sole author, but you would say that he is the final editor, and it has his flavor, his way of talking about theology and organizing things. But it definitely is Luther's theology.
It also has, from the pen of Melanchthon, at least as the final editor, the a very definite tone of, not a conciliatory tone, an irenic tone, not in your face kind of a tone.
That's correct. And that's also part of the prince's intention. The princes were involved with this at every stage of the draft. They read copies, or their chamberlains did, and they said, no, Luther, you said that there is two kingdoms. There's the left and the right, and we're dealing with the left kingdom that's been established by God, and that's the emperor, and we have to respect him. And so we do not want to be in your face. We want to give all due respect that's proper to Emperor Charles V. And so the way that you word this is very important for us. See, they understood court ceremony and all that, which was different than the academic realm. Because in the academic realm, you could go kind of at each other, throats, almost with your, you know, going for the jugular, as it were. But in the court, it was very almost sedate. But sort not when they got out in the battlefield, but in the court, you had to show absolute respect and courtesy, and that it's certainly reflected in the Augsburg Confession.
So after the Augsburg Confession is presented, the emperor realizes that he does not have a political revolt on his hand, but really, in the case of the Lutherans at least, a theological debate on his hand. Do the Roman Catholics respond, and if so, how?
The Roman Catholics respond with several documents. One of them is the confutation of the Augsburg Confession. I forgot right at the moment who is the author of that. And then after that was a response to the confutation by, again, Philip Melanchthon. And Melanchthon wrote the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. So the... this is the Apology helps us understand in more detail. As I said before, the Augsburg Confession is kind of sparse. It's brief. It sets out a statement of the position without indigoing all the arguments. The Apology does bring out the arguments. And if you look at the number of pages in the Apology, almost a third of it is devoted to justification by faith alone. The other one that takes a lot of time is the matter of ecclesiastical power, when princes and bishops are the same person.
And by apology, it bears pointing out, if you didn't already, that we're talking about apology in the sense of a defense, not in the sense of we're sorry we said it.
Correct. That's again, those are Latin terms that have slightly different meanings.
All right. Where does the Augsburg Confession begin now that we get into its content? What does it seek to set out initially when it's confessing the faith of the Reformers?
Well, it has a preface, and it tries to explain to the reader why this thing was written, and as it often says, that we are trying to be in obedience to the emperor. And then after that, it gets into the theological matters, and it begins with the doctrines of faith, articles of faith and doctrine. And it's divided in terms of the headings between two chief portions. The one part's about articles of faith and doctrine, and the second part is about the chief abuses that they are rejecting. And the first thing is the article of God, which deals with the doctrine of the Trinity, and it affirms, immediately affirms, the decree of the Council of Nicaea, which we find today in the Nicene Creed. And from then, and also, and this I think is they're using some political smarts, they show that they condemn all of the ancient heresies that were condemned in the early church. So they are, if you look at the original drafts, like going back to 1529, what you find is a statement of faith and a Bible passage. And that's, for example, in the Schwabach Articles. But by the time you get to the final draft, not only do you have Bible passages, you have references to the early church and the debates that were settled there. So that the real argument is not only that we are faithful to the Bible, but that we are the true successors of the early church when this was all adopted by Constantine and set up in around the 4th or 5th century.
So the logic behind this kind of two-form way of confessing the faith, we believe, teach, and confess, positive. We reject and condemn, negative, had both the political aim of setting themselves apart from genuine heresies and stating their faith, but it also seems to be a tremendous way of explaining what you believe. It's not sufficient simply to say, I believe this, without also saying, and I also reject this other thing, too.
Right. And I think it's kind of what we would call not reinventing the wheel. If you already have a tool that's devised to accomplish something, why do you need to go out and reinvent it? Well, the church has been dealing for centuries with errors of interpretation or errors of positions of doctrine. And these things became heresies because they're subtle and they convince people. So why do you need to go back over this all again? The Lutherans just, for example, the first thing it says under the rejection, it says, we are opposed to the Manichaeans, who posit two gods, one good and one evil. So we don't need to go there again. That's already settled. We're not a Manichaean, and we have no inkling of agreement with them. And then what that does is it clears up a lot of things. There were a lot of accusations made against the Lutherans, for example, that they might have been Manichaeans or Arians or whatever else. And you say, no, that's not our position. We disagree with that entirely. Then the critics are wrong. And then you have to you narrow it down to the real issues. And that's part of what the rejections are about.
We're talking with Dr. Martin Noland. He's director of the Concordia Historical Institute, based here in St. Louis, about the Magna Carta of the Reformation, the Augsburg Confession. Now, it necessarily requires quite a bit of conversation about the historical circumstances. We've only begun to talk about the content of this great confession. A little later in our conversation, you'll often hear Lutherans talk about the unaltered Augsburg Confession. Now, why is that? Well, apparently, somebody did some tampering with the Augsburg Confession in the latter years of the Reformation that required that qualification as well. We'll talk about its influence in Protestant Christianity. And right when we come back, Article 1, God, Article 2, Original Sin, Article 3, Son of God, Article 4, Justification, the heart of the debate, the real issue at hand. We'll talk about that fourth article of the Augsburg Confession, how it is a man is declared right before God by grace through faith for the sake of Christ alone. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back for the third hour, our conversation with Pastor Martin Noland continues, and we invite your questions and comments on the Augsburg Confession. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.